Hey, listeners, a quick note here. We are so excited for you to get to spend some time with Tim McIntosh and hope you love the episode. We wanted to jump in here and say it is mid-April and our book fair weekend is almost here. So if you have not registered yet, we are entering your last week. This is like the last 7 days to do it. The deadline is next Tuesday, the 25th. The link to register is pinned in the Facebook group. Details are pinned in the Facebook group. And once you register, you will get an email from us the week of with all the details. So we're saving Elizabeth's address. You know, we're not putting that out there right now. But we will get you all that you need once you register the week of. And can't wait to see you!
And if you're not able to come in person to the event, we are doing our first live Zoom book club where you will get to come on to a Zoom meeting and talk about The Island of Sea Women with the three of us. That is going to be Monday night, May 1st at 8:30 p.m. Eastern time. So that is going to be so much fun, and we hope many, many of you will be marking your calendars to get online. We'll probably say a little bit about the book at the beginning, and then we will open it up for questions and discussion. And we can't wait to see you there. Welcome to Book Fair. We help thoughtful women find wholesome, life-affirming books for themselves and their families.
Are you tired of picking up the latest new release and finding it full of junk you don't want in your life? You are in the right place.
This show shares curated content, and we do it together within a fun, book-loving community. So pull up a chair at the table and join the feast.
Well, welcome back, listeners, to another episode of Book Fair. Today, we are just beyond excited to have Tim McIntosh with us. Tim, I like to say of Close Reads fame, because that is where you are famous to Amanda and I. So Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tricia. Thank you.
We are just so excited to have you. I am going to read a quick bio just to give our listeners a little bit of an idea of who you are. Tim McIntosh is a former classics professor, a Shakespeare actor, director, and teacher. You can hear him on his Shakespeare podcast, The Play's the Thing, and on its sister podcast, Close Reads. Currently, Tim is creative director at Westfall Gold, major donor fundraiser agency. So, Tim, we are so excited that you're here.
Thank you very much. I'm really excited to be here.
And I'm going to say I'm just plain old tickle pink because, like Tim, I hail from Georgia, and we were just talking about how not only are we from the same county, but we were down on the street level knowing where the other one grew up. So that was very exciting.
We grew up really close to each other, didn't we, Amanda?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. On the street level, we were figuring out, it sounds like we lived both in Lilburn and we both lived in Lawrenceville, and our paths surely crossed at the Gwinnett Mall at some point in the past. The we just didn't mall. Know each other then.
Yes.
Which yeah. I've heard that Gwinnett Mall has been a, how would you say it? It's a filming location for Stranger Things. Have you guys seen the show? I've seen like the first series, but I lost track of it after that. Yeah, they filmed a lot of Gwinnett.
I have heard that.
Yeah, right. Me too. I used to work at the Chick-fil-A at Gwinnett Place.
And now it's famous. There's a lot of Georgia in a lot of films right now. Walking Dead was largely filmed in Georgia.
Yeah.
A lot of the Avengers series through there. They've got some kind of a deal there.
Yeah.
Atlanta. Come to Georgia and film your films.
Yeah. And save money on the back end because we have really great tax codes for filmmakers, apparently, is part of the issue.
Probably it.
Yeah.
Super fun. Well, I got to meet Tim last year at the Close Reads Retreat, which our listeners have heard me wax long and eloquent about as well. So that was super, super fun for me. And I'm just super excited that we get to catch up again today.
I am too. I've been looking forward to this. Anyone who wants to talk about Shakespeare, I am like ready to do it. Galen and I had some friends over last night, and we were trying to define the word nerd. Like, what exactly is a nerd? Because I think when I was in high school, it was just a slander. It was a way of slandering somebody. You're such a nerd. But now it just means, I think, any person who has a sort of a drive to really master any sort of subject or just be enthralled with any sort of subject. And so I am a Shakespeare nerd. It sounds like you guys might be Shakespeare nerds. So this is going to be a very enjoyable conversation.
Yes, for sure. Well, I would say that we are probably reading and literature nerds who want to learn more and more about how to appreciate things like Shakespeare. So we probably have a little bit of varying degrees of experience or knowledge with it. And so we definitely wanted to have you on as we are trying to grow in that area ourselves, but also to introduce our listeners to it, because we are kind of on this journey with our community to read and enjoy wholesome, life-affirming books. Like, that is our mission. So we love to have people on who can sort of open the door and help us walk in to some of these major literary, beautiful worlds that we may not have been exposed to yet.
Mm.
So you are definitely, you know, the expert in the room. So tell us, how did you first come to Shakespeare?
I arrived at Shakespeare pretty late in my life. I think I was in my mid to late 30s. And I would say that I respected Shakespeare before I kind of fell in love with him, because I think anybody who cares about the written word has to respect Shakespeare. But I wasn't curling up with Othello on a cold winter's night, you know, or anything like that. The thing that changed it for me, and I can almost remember the moment, is when I had started to do a little acting where I lived in Eugene, Oregon. And one of my former castmates asked me to play a Shakespeare scene with her. And so just as a courtesy to her, because we acted together and we were friends, I said, sure, yeah, I'll do it. But I had never tried to act Shakespeare before. So I showed up for the first rehearsal with my friend Mary and the director, Sparky Roberts, who... Sparky taught at a local college, and she would put on once or twice a year what she called a Shakespeare showcase. And so she had pre-assigned Mary and I a scene from Measure for Measure, in which I was playing the brother of Isabella. And Isabella, in the scene that we were going to act, comes to me and basically says, hey, I'm really sorry, but I just talked to the judge, and you're going to die. You're condemned to die. And so the scene, that's just what the scene is, me kind of realizing that I was condemned to death. And the words, I could not believe how powerful the words were and how moved I was when I started memorizing them and actually speaking them aloud. It transformed Shakespeare for me. I can still remember the lines. He kind of puts on a brave face, does the brother, and then he says, "I, but to die and go we know not where. To lie in cold obstruction and to rot this sensible warm motion to become a kneaded clod." The sensible warm motion, I think, is a reference to his heart. This sensible warm motion to become, like, basically a piece of dirt, a kneaded clod. I thought, oh my gosh, there's so much going on here. And it was so fun. And then we got to perform it for an audience, and it was absolutely exhilarating. And I kind of just... Sparky, the director, every time she would do something, I would ask if I could participate, and she gave me harder and harder roles, you know, just to kind of challenge me. And that's my kind of, like, Shakespeare origin story. That's how I fell in love.
That is so amazing. Great. And I have to say, encouraging, because I'm around a lot of classical educators and mamas like Elizabeth and Amanda who are doing classical education with their kids. And I think it can be kind of easy to feel like, well, I'm never really going to get this if I didn't start when I was younger.
Right.
You know, it kind of feels like you're way behind.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I am going, I have a little bit of a burr under my saddle about the way that we teach Shakespeare. And I don't know how you guys teach Shakespeare. But I think that part of the reason that I didn't fall in love with Shakespeare until late in my life is because I had very well-meaning literature teachers that taught Shakespeare as if Shakespeare wrote novels, not plays. And so whenever Amanda, this is your experience too?
I had not thought of it that way until you brought it up. You've done some things recently and shared on your page. And it was right as I was coming into the time where I was about to open this up and maybe see what I can do with a second grader on this, knowing he's not going to get it. I don't expect him to get it.
Right.
This is a first take. But I loved your idea of this was not meant to be read. It was meant to be watched.
Yeah. Yeah. And to ask our students to just sit down and read Shakespeare. I mean, I'm telling you, I can do it. I'm pretty practiced, and I still struggle with just sitting down and reading him. But if I have to either watch a play being performed, or if I have to actually stand up on my feet and perform it myself, it's a completely different experience. And so I'm a little bit on a crusade to try to get literature teachers who love Shakespeare to not think of him as a novelist, because he wasn't, but as a dramatist, and to like teach him accordingly.
Absolutely. Love it. I remember in ninth grade reading Romeo and Juliet. I don't actually remember reading it, but I remember watching the movie and just that there was nudity and I was scandalized. And that was
the Claire Danes version, I'm sure.
That's what I remember about Romeo and Juliet. And then I did a play. I did Midsummer Night's Dream in high school. Thought, wow, there's more to this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot more to it.
So maybe my high school teacher did a good job, because I think we did read a good bit of Romeo and Juliet, but then we all had to perform a scene from it. And just like you were saying, Tim, I can still remember, but soft, what light through yonder window breaks?
Yes.
It is the east and Juliet is the west. Like, and I loved it. I loved it.
Good on your teacher, whoever she was. Blessings on her.
Yes, absolutely.
I want to say, since then, becoming a homeschool mom and pursuing the classical model, of course you need to pursue Shakespeare. And so I found help, because I was intimidated about how to teach your children Shakespeare by Ken Ludwig. And also Misty Winkler of Scholle Sisters has great resources on her blog, which is simplyconvivial.com. I highly recommend that to other moms out there that would like a literal blueprint. Just reading a picture book of the plot. It's for the kids, but it was for me too. Or like a Charles Lamb summary. And then you listen and you watch it and maybe read along. Or maybe read afterwards, but memorize lines, act it out. It's so fun. The boys love the sword fights. So that's been our journey to redeem that a bit.
I love that. Can I tell you guys a quick story about my two godsons? When I was living in Eugene, I had a family, four kids came to a performance that I did in the park of Macbeth, and I was playing Macbeth. It was the first like big Shakespeare role that I'd ever had. And there's a famous monologue in Macbeth. It's referred to by shorthand as Is This the Dagger monologue. So that's where we're going to go in a second. But before we get there, when the family shows up, I saw them maybe, 30 minutes before the play begins. And I run out from backstage. Hey, how are you guys doing? It's so good to see you. And their oldest son, who maybe, I'm going to guess he was maybe six at the time, had a little wooden sword with them. And hey, Soren, you brought your sword. Yeah. Didn't think anything of it. Went backstage, play begins. And about halfway through the play, I come out for the monologue, Is This a Dagger I See Before Me? And the monologue is Macbeth imagining, or actually seeing maybe, this dagger leading him to the king's chamber and he is going to kill the king. And so he feels like he's being kind of like drawn by this kind of like metaphysical force embodied in this dagger, and it's going to take him to the king. So I start the monologue. Is this a dagger I see before me, the handle toward my hand? Come, let me clutch thee. I have thee not, yet I see thee still. So while I'm saying these lines, I'm kind of reaching out for this fictional dagger. And on my right, out of the corner of my eye, I see something kind of in the corner of my eye, sort of floating upward toward the horizon. But I'm not going to look. You guys know what it is. I'm not going to look because it was Shakespeare in the Park. There's like drunk people all the time at the performances, and they're trying to get your attention. Now you got to stay in character. So I stay focused. I continue the monologue. I finish the monologue and I go backstage. My castmates, meanwhile, they're laughing when I get backstage, and they're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that. And I said, what happened? I knew something was happening, but I didn't know what it was. And they said, when you started seeing the dagger, this little boy, it was my godson, he reached up with his toy sword to offer you. He thought that you were asking for his sword. It was so great. It was so great. I kind of wish that now that I had like seen it and I could have acknowledged it. Okay. Then there's a second part of the story. I'll keep it really short. My two godsons apparently just fell in love with Shakespeare. But what they thought Shakespeare was very different in their kind of child's imagination from what Shakespeare really was. So I went over to my friend's house and they said, hey, Soren and Elliot would like to put on a Shakespeare performance for you in the backyard. We've made a little stage for them, and would you be willing to? And I was like, that sounds great.
Oh my goodness.
So they each had their toy swords, and their dad had built this little wooden stage for them. And I sat down in the backyard by myself. It's just the three of us. And the two boys kind of enter from opposite sides of the stage, and it's like Shakespeare performance time. And so this is what Shakespeare performance meant to them. Soren, I am the great king who will bring a sword at you, and then fight, 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 fight. And then they'd break up, and then Elliot would say, your sword is not aboard this ship. Fight, 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 fight. And they did that about like five times, and that was their Shakespeare play. It was one of the best. Totally. Best Shakespeare play I've ever attended.
It is precious.
Oh,
it
was amazing.
Great. But to your point, if their exposure had just been them sitting on the couch and their parents just reading Shakespeare to them like a novel, they would not have thought that's what Shakespeare was.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
And they would have never cared to react it out at all.
Yeah.
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 So Amanda kind of mentioned a couple things she's done with her kids to introduce them to Shakespeare. So we'll just jump to that. What you said, you're kind of on a crusade. So, you know, some of our listeners are moms and homeschool moms. What do you suggest for introducing kids to Shakespeare?
It depends on the age. I have worked mostly with, high school and college students, but I've started to incorporate younger kids into Shakespeare performances that I help direct and produce. And so what I recommend, if you're going to do it in a school setting or in a classroom setting, is I'm going to talk about two different things. If you've got young kids who you think can memorize a line or two, then have them memorize a line or two as part of a larger group scene. The scene that I'm thinking of, excuse me, is Mark Antony's speech, Friends, Romans, Countrymen, Lend Me Your Ears. You need a lot of extras in that scene. I think it has at least six citizen speaking parts. And kids, relatively young kids, can play the citizens who are, they're angry, they're ready to riot. Kids love it. And they each get one or two lines. And of course, they're waiting with bated breath to say, hark, hear Mark Antony speak to us of the will. They're waiting for these lines, and it's such a thrill for them, and they get to go home and their grandparents attended the play. Oh, you were so great when you said read us the will. So I think sprinkling in small speaking parts into large group performances is a great way to get young kids kind of acclimated. Plus, they're hearing the language over and over and over as Mark Antony goes through this beautiful, powerful piece of rhetoric. Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend your ears. I come not to bury Caesar, or I come not to praise Caesar, but to bury him. They're hearing the language and they're getting acclimated to it. It's kind of like creating a little pattern in their mind and with their tongues. So that's the way that I would start if you can with kids, younger kids. Now, the trick is high school students and maybe even like more mature or older middle school students. The big challenge is, to be honest, it's the self-consciousness that comes with that age. Nobody wants to stand up and try to fumble out these words that are really complex that you are going to surely mispronounce and you don't really know what they mean. So how do you empower middle school, high school students to actually just give it a shot? Well, I'm so glad you asked, because I think I've kind of stumbled on a little trick. And here's the trick. And I encourage everyone to use this. The first time that you are trying to get your high school students to stand up in a classroom or on a stage and try to say these words, I challenge you to challenge them to make it the worst performance that they have ever done in their life.
Perfect.
Right?
Perfect. Invite them to be all the weird for the moment.
Absolutely.
Just say the lines.
Just say the lines. And so what happens is what they do is they do a terrible performance and everyone is laughing. Everyone's loosening up and all the pressure is off. All the pressure is off. So after you do the worst performance ever and everybody's laughing, and then the next thing you do is, okay, now let's go as fast as we can possibly can. This is the speed drill performance of Shakespeare. So then they run through. It's a speed drill, bah, 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 as fast as they can. And that ends up being funny also. But now secretly what you've done is they have said the lines through two times, right? Now third time, do the biggest, most outlandish performance with the biggest gestures and the loudest sighs. Do the biggest performance that you can do. Now, by the time they get through this third performance, what I have found is that, number one, the words are starting to make sense to them, even when they don't really know what they mean. They're starting to kind of resonate with them. The second thing that's happening is that big performance is actually kind of where you want them to end up on performance day. Because what they think is a really big gesture, in my experience, it's not that big of a gesture. It's just kind of an appropriate sized gesture. And so you're already getting them to kind of, in a way, act like a Shakespearean actor. They've gone through the language three times. And for me, then that's when I slow down and start picking the words that are just their Shakespearean English. We don't know what they mean, and start trying to define some of these words, because then the students will have really good guesses about what these different words mean. And they're into the text, which is where you want them to be. You know, it's where you want them to be. You eventually have to get there. What does this word mean? What does this sentence mean? What is this character trying to do?
Yeah.
Well, genius. I'm hearing also that they've heard their own voice, which is fear number one. They've addressed fear number two, which is being really bad. They addressed that together. Then they threw in some extra for good measure. I love that thought process. That really addresses their age. But also any of us kind of would go about it that way of like, I'm going to feel better if I don't have to worry about being bad at it.
For sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. And you just, I mean, it's intimidating. I think to pretend that it's not intimidating is to kind of threaten, it's to threaten the stability of your class, because everybody else is just worried half to death how to say these words. Just have fun with it from the very beginning.
That's great.
That's a great Shakespeare hack.
Yeah, it's a great Shakespeare hack.
So now I'm going to ask you a really hard question. So we're talking about, you know, how to introduce kids, because even you kind of said anyone who respects the written word is going to have some respect for Shakespeare. Yeah. But why? Like, what makes Shakespeare so great? Why is he worth all the trouble to get into him, understand him, experience him, appreciate him?
I want to, can I jump in and add a second part to that question? And that is not only why is he the best, how does he move us closer to truth, goodness, and beauty? Mm. The answer to that might be related.
Yeah. Maybe I could do Trish's question first and Amanda's question second. For me, the two things that separate Shakespeare from everybody else are the language. We're all readers in this room, right? I've read a lot of books and I've read a lot of old books. No one compares to him. John Donne. I love John Donne, but man, I get kind of stymied with John Donne's prose sometimes. I love Dante, and Dante jumps off the page also. But for me, no one compares to Shakespeare's language. It is light and playful one moment. It is elegant and staid the next moment. And I just love the sound of the words in the air. And I just think he's the best I've ever encountered. The second thing that I would say is he is a psychologist almost without parallel. Most of his plots and his characters come from existing plays. I think the one exception that I know of is A Midsummer Night's Dream seems like it is Shakespeare's plotting. There's no, as far as we can see, existing plot for A Midsummer Night's Dream. Whereas Macbeth, there was a kind of Macbeth, same thing for Hamlet, So he took his plots from elsewhere, and he was a fine dramatist as far as creating tension using plots, but we have to say that's not where his originality was. But his psychology, his ability to see the motives of men and women, especially men and women under dire, dire circumstances, and men and women in rapturous love, like in the kind of like most ecstatic of human emotions. I've never read anybody like him. He is so profound. He knows the human heart in a way that is like preternatural. It's incredible. It's just incredible. And that kind of leads me to what my answer to Amanda would be. Like, how does he lead us to truth, goodness, and beauty? Well, I think it starts with his ability to understand what motivates human life. The other thing that I would say is that he had an incredible ability to raise profoundly philosophical and difficult subjects to the public consciousness in a way that you walk out of his plays. And if you can kind of pick up on what those themes are, then you walk out of those plays and you're still buzzing about them. I'll give you one example. The play Richard II is not one of Shakespeare's best known plays, but it's fantastic. It's a superb play. And it's the story of a usurper to the throne. This warrior comes in and he challenges the king and ends up overthrowing the king being Richard II. Richard II's a bad king. He's a bad king. He's not doing his duty. He wants to instead kind of write poetry. And Henry Bolingbroke comes in, challenges Richard II, overthrows him. Now, that's not news. What's news is that the idea of the divine right of kings comes up over and over and over in this play. Didn't God seat this king on the throne for this particular time? Who are we to overthrow him, even if he's a bad king? Well, this is kind of percolating all through the play. And if you're paying attention, you're like, oh goodness, what did English society do when they had a bad king or a bad queen on the throne? And that king was causing great harm, and we believe that God put them on the throne. What do we do, though, when someone challenges that king? It's a thorny question back then. And Shakespeare raises it, discusses it in a very vibrant way, and also manages to keep his head attached to his shoulders, which I think might be his greatest success at the time, because there were a lot of subjects at that time that would have resulted in his execution, but he managed to stay alive, which might have been his greatest triumph of all.
That's amazing. I've never thought about it that way before.
I like the idea. You were talking about Shakespeare in the Park, and I'm going back to those kids again, thinking about how this matters in my life and my teaching my child and my experiences with it. Because before trying to teach this as a homeschool mom, it was high school, you know, and it was boring. I read an article about how we approach Shakespeare so differently, also because our experiences of going to plays is so formal. And, you know, you talked about Shakespeare in the Park being rowdy and drunks and all that. And that was closer to how it was originally done. I mean, you're re-shouting lines for people who say, I didn't hear what you said. And it was rowdy.
Right.
And we don't come to it that way. We come to it with so much reverence that it, on the one hand, deserves, but we miss some of that experience in it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely right. And a friend told me recently that they attended what they called it an original performance rendition of a Shakespeare play, which was they basically used what they thought were the kind of performing expectations from 1600 during this modern day performance. And that's one of the things that they said, Elizabeth, was that the rehearsal time was greatly truncated. And so they had a line caller off stage that would help the actors with the lines if they forgot the lines. I want to caveat that by saying I think we don't rely on our memories in 2023 the way that somebody in 17th century, 16th century England would have relied on their memory. So I think that the actors then had much greater capacity to memorize lines for a long period of time than we do. We just don't exercise that muscle as much. Still, they had shorter rehearsal times and they had a line caller. Apparently they used a lot of what would have been off the rack clothing. So costume departments would have been pretty limited. We have huge access to clothes and, you know, pretty sophisticated costuming. They would not have had such sophisticated costuming just because the cost would have been exorbitant. So that's another difference that in 1600, we would have just seen people in what would have been the equivalent of kind of like plain clothes to us.
In a Close Reads episode, Tim, I remember you recommending a book about the players in Shakespeare's troupe, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah.
Do you happen to remember the name of that book? I'm putting you on the spot. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I don't remember the name of the author, but if I recall the book, it is called The Greatest Actors in the World. And yeah, man, that's one of those books that like only nerds read, but I loved it. I loved that book.
Yeah.
What the author did was relatively simple. He just went back to the historical record and said, I think this actor, Richard Burbage, for example, played Hamlet and Othello and this character and this character and this character. And I think this character was the clown that Shakespeare's troupe hired in 1592 or whatever it was. And that clown character probably played the clown in King Lear. And so they just take what we do know of the actors in Shakespeare's troupe and they put together who they think played different roles. Now, why is that interesting? I think it's interesting there's one thing that I really took from that book. Men played women's characters in Shakespeare's day, as we know, right? There was a period of time that Shakespeare wrote a series of great female characters, just great female characters. The hypothesis of, and then they stopped. They just like, and I wish I could tell you exactly what, you know, like string these roles together. What were they? My memory fails me here, but they just stopped. The theory of the author of the book, The Greatest Actors in the World, says that he thinks that there was a young man who played these female roles, who was a really, really fine actor, and his voice had not yet broken, right? He hadn't entered puberty yet. And so he played all of these female roles to great acclaim, and Shakespeare knew what a great actor he had. And so he wrote for this young man to play these roles. Then the young man's voice broke, and Shakespeare didn't write great female characters for a while. He wrote kind of like secondary female characters that were very strong, but not like Lady Macbeth. Lady Macbeth is a great role. He had to stop because the theory being this young man's voice broke.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. I've had that in my TBR ever since, but it's just, I dearly wish I could go back and see those actors like Richard Burbage, like, oh, it must have been amazing. And even just looking how modern actors, how there's kind of a difference in the way over time they perform the monologues and so forth. I wonder how they did it.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder too. I really do.
Okay, friends, I am interrupting this conversation right here because our conversation with Tim was so amazing, we decided to keep all of it and divide it into two episodes. So I hope you have really enjoyed this first half of the conversation, and I am inviting you to come back next week to hear Tim talk about how we get into Shakespeare as an adult. He's already talked about some things that we can do to introduce Shakespeare to children or to teenagers, but how can you, just sitting at your house by yourself, how can you approach Shakespeare in a way that will be fun and exciting? He's going to talk about one of his favorite Shakespeare plays that no one has ever heard of and why it is so great. And he's going to tell a story about a semi-violent moment on stage playing Hamlet that was one of the best acting experiences he ever had. That, among so many other gems. So we hope that you will join us next week for part two of our conversation on Shakespeare with Tim McIntosh. Until then, happy reading. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this, subscribe to Book Fair Podcast.
Join our private Facebook group. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram, or email us at chat@bookfairpodcast.com.
And you can help us continue to grow. Share an episode with a friend, mention us on social media, and leave a review in your podcast app. We'll see you next Tuesday.